with that.
Jazz.
Bastard.
So, do you have something for this? I have something for this, possibly. I don't know. Do you have something for this or no?
Fire away, dude. No, that's
oh,
great.
I did, but I lost it. I was going to quote Latin at you, but I closed the screen. So, anyway, there's some famous Latin tag in Horace from the Ars Poetica where he talks about, in certain passages where it seems like Homer is sleeping, it's not Homer who's sleeping, but we who dream. What Horace means by that is there are passages in Homer that seem dull and bad. And Horace says, they're not dull and bad. You're dull and bad. You're an idiot. You just don't get the genius that is at work in this difficult passage that you find boring. And that's apropos for our podcast today. Because why, Pat?
Will Illinois Mike. That's a joke that we'll be calling back to in a little bit later. Yeah, we are dealing, it was your idea, it's kind of, at first it was kind of best known, most notorious kind of failures, and we wanted to do established jazz musicians. We're not going to like punch down at somebody that you never heard of or has kind of a third rank reputation. And then it kind of turned into, I don't know, this is kind of, some of these are just fires and some of them are just weird.
Yeah. You
know, it's just kind of odd projects by big musicians, right? Some are dismissible, some aren't necessarily, but they're all kind of strange.
Yeah, I mean, we could have just done anything by Sun Ra, but we picked four musicians who are giants in their field, just giants standing out in their field. But occasionally the field they're standing in is left field, and these are
there you go.
These are weird selections by...
Cows may have been in that field. We're not sure.
Cows may have been in that field. They may have stepped in what the cows left behind and then committed it to tape. So those are what we're looking at today.
Right. Very weird stuff. And I'm Pat. He's still Mike. So our selections today kind of run the gamut. They're not similar to one another. They're just all strange. So we're doing Thelonious Monk's Monk's Blues from 1969. And that's kind of his last major label release. He does a couple studio sessions with Black Lion. He dies in 82, but really is inactive since 75. But really after this and the Black Lion sessions, the only other remaining recordings of him are live. Things are kind of winding down for him. This may be the reason. And then Duke Ellington's A Drum is a Woman, the soundtrack from a TV show that is kind of a, well, we'll talk about it. It's a weird story about jazz in a sense. We're going to do Bill Evans Plays the Theme from VIPs and Others, 1963, and that's the simplest one to discuss. It's just Bill Evans selling out.
Yes.
And then finally, this is under Freddie Hubbard's name. It's not really his album per se, but he's the headliner. Sing Me a Song of Song Me. That is a Turkish composer who is also a producer on Atlantic puts this project together.
And you can tell this guy had juice because that's the only way this gets made. I mean, this guy, he knew, he had pictures of someone at Atlantic doing bad things to puppies or kittens because there's no way you get this produced unless you know where the bodies are buried.
Absolutely. And, you know, people have pointed out that this comes out in 71. This is kind of the era of producers' albums. David Axelrod is a example of that. The guy that did some Cannibal Adderley projects, also did his own Rock Messiah.
Joel Doran is in his heyday at this time.
Yeah. So, right. It's just a time when music was so profitable and such a huge industry that the people at the levers of power were given vanity projects, basically, that they could do. And this is a bizarre one. So I don't know where you want to begin, whether we want to get the easy Bill Evans one out of the way first or
I don't care. Should we you tell me. It doesn't matter to me.
All right. Well, what I suggest is we go from kind of easiest to pigeonhole to strangest.
Okay.
And let's begin with Bill Evans Plays the Theme from VIPs and Others. This is a album that was a Bill Evans playing in front of an orchestra conducted by Klaus Ogerman from 63. It was recorded for the MGM label, and part of this album's notoriety comes that at one point, Verve, which bought up MGM, released an 18 CD set of Bill Evans's music on its label and associated labels. In this stainless steel box, it was rusting the minute you took it out of the packaging, and notorious monument to one of their best-known musicians. And Bill Evans plays the music from B.I.P.'s. They could not find room for that on 18 discs.
Golly.
They just omitted it.
Golly.
So, yeah, it wasn't quite complete, but their feeling was it's best if we just don't include this. And he, I think, originally asked for this to be released under his original German name. He was very ambivalent.
What's Bill's original German name? I didn't know he...
You know, I don't know. I found it, then I lost it, then I, or a pseudonym or something. He didn't want, of course, the whole point of it was to get his name in front of a wider audience. So that would have been kind of stupid.
Yeah.
On the other hand, so was this. So Place Music from VIPs, thoughts on this interesting detour in the great Bill Evans's recording.
Well, career. This reminds me of many a Anthony Hopkins film. For some reason, lately on Netflix, I've been catching movies from time. I don't always. I watch movies from a lot of different places, but I've seen a couple of movies recently with Anthony Hopkins. And these are movies that used to go straight to DVD, but now Netflix picks them up, and it's Anthony Hopkins being Anthony Hopkins in whatever setting. He's being his usual creepy or cryptic or interesting self. He always has interesting line readings, but he's cashing a check. These are bad films. They're consistently bad films. And it's clear that it costs him nothing to make these. Like, there's no emotional investment. There's no psychic investment. He's not making any effort whatsoever with these films. They're easy. And his name alone surely gives it a certain amount of cachet. This is, after all, Hannibal Lecter. Another guy who is guilty of this is Samuel L. Jackson, who after the Tarantino films, he just appears in movie after movie, and he's the same guy in every film. He's never shy, retiring, weird, contemplative. He's always that guy who talks this loud. I'm gonna talk. You know, he raises his voice and says motherfucker a lot. And these are just, he's just cashing a check. And that's what Bill Evans is doing here. This is Bill Evans cashing a check. This cost him nothing. So for a man who is famous for just bleeding all over the keys, you have the sense that he's drunk or bored out of his mind and just noodling along here. None of this costs him anything. And I didn't really sense much.
Except his soul.
I was hoping for maybe a little investment on The Man with the Golden Arm, because that's one of my favorite novels, turned into a terrible film by Otto Preminger. Meh. And then Laura, another Otto Preminger creation. But Laura was the song that the movie created. There was no song until the movie Laura.
Right, the movie is
nothing but this. It's one of the worst good movies ever. It's regarded as a good movie, but when you watch it, you're like, why is this good? This is terrible. It's a horrible film. And they play Laura and nothing but Laura on that soundtrack. And that song was written for that goddamn movie. And now everyone thinks it's a jazz standard. And you might think that Bill Evans would have something to give on Laura, but by golly, his veins are tapped out. There's just nothing there. He is so not invested in this event. It's breathtaking to witness this level of cynicism in a player who is known for his lush romantic playing. I don't know if I want to call it embarrassment, because I would imagine that, you know, to fans of Bill Evans, they listen to this and it's like he's winking at them, or maybe. I mean, I like to think that he's winking at me. I hope he's saying to me, I hope you got this for free and you didn't pay anything for it, because God knows it cost me nothing to record. I don't know. It's not good. The arrangements are really schmaltzy. I just don't... Why you need Bill Evans to play piano with these arrangements mystifies me. You could have any reasonably competent piano technician come in and bang this stuff out. I just don't feel like there's anything here. And that's hard to say for a Bill Evans album. This has got to be the most empty, emotion-free Bill Evans album I know of. What would you say?
Yeah, well, I just want to point listeners to episode 86, where we discuss what Jimmy Smith does to Laura. And it is actionable in most courts of law. So you might want to check that one out. He does an amazing live rendition of it, and no one walks out of that unbloodied. Yeah, I've talked before, Evans is really a sensitive plant, man. His context matters a lot, even though he kind of repeated himself and he kind of kept building context around himself after the Great Trio broke up because Scott LaFaro was killed in that car accident. They were somewhat similar in their dynamic. It matters to him that he is in congenial context. And, you know, if he's playing with Philly Joe Jones, for instance, a surprisingly well-loved drummer by Bill, he gets a little bit more aggressive, you know, whatever he is.
Eddie Gomez, and when Eddie Gomez is on bass, he's a little more engaged.
Right, yeah, absolutely. It's really important to him that he have musicians around him to kind of both not challenge him too much. He doesn't, you know, he's not ready to, like, do it with Anthony Braxton, but do stimulate him. And so here, yeah, you just feel like his personality completely leaches out of his playing. I would be hard-pressed for anybody, I think, unless just an absolute scholar of the man, to identify him from these passages. And you wonder, it's very much, this is really truly M.O.R., middle of the road, AM radio, I don't know, oldie station is quite the right, you know, adult, contemporary, I don't know what you want to call it. It's a format that I feel like was playing old music in the 70s when I was a kid. That was the music for the 50-pluses in 1972. And I don't know if it exists anymore, this kind of thing where you get a huge orchestra and everything's very pillowy. And, you know, occasionally there's a little stimulation in the rhythm section, but the point is you play the melody in a pretty way. And that's pretty much it. You know, he improvises a couple minutes, but you don't get his famous, you know, kind of close harmonies on it. You don't feel like the arrangements reflect the kinds of colors or moods that Bill Evans brings to music. It's like they took a generic project and just stuck him in it, and he just absolutely, like a chameleon, disappears in it. I mean, there's just nothing left of Bill.
Well, and what else to be said here is these cuts are, I think one of them goes over 3 minutes. These are all 2.5 minute cuts. And if ever there was a player who required a little space to expand and stretch out, it's Bill Evans. You know, he does not show up to his best effect in short 2.5 minute. You know, he's not Ellington, who could do an orchestration in 2.5 minutes. That's not really Bill Evans. I think of him in 5, 6, 7 minute stretches, generally speaking. So these are very short cuts. There's almost no room for him to be himself if he were inclined to be himself, which he clearly isn't.
Yeah, it's like a 30 minute album, 12 tracks. I guess my feeling about it is I'm willing to listen to fairly heavily orchestrated mood music if it's intelligently done. I mean, you could argue that the latter half of Brian Ferry's career is to some degree,
right.
But there's typically something interesting there. And the thing is that Ferry suffuses his personality through these hyper-produced, mellow adult pop productions. I don't see the point in doing a production like this where it really is so generic sounding that you haven't sold Bill Evans to anybody.
Right.
In other words, if you heard this, you wouldn't think that Bill Evans, you know, the only thing that he would strike you as is a purveyor of the kind of stuff that, I don't know, Frontin, Teicher, whoever played in that era. Again, these musicians who I don't know they exist anymore. I don't know if there's a market for it. I guess Spotify has a robot do this now.
Mantovani.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, somebody like, you know, right. And just how this isn't going to turn somebody on to Evans because there is no hook of what he does well. So anyway, yeah, there's a reason this wasn't put in the box. This is what it sounds like. Everybody who gives it 1 or 2 stars is quite right. You aren't missing anything. You know, if you've really gotten deeply into Bill Evans, you can keep putting off listening to this one again and again and again and listen to anything else pretty much.
Yeah.
And you're safe.
Yeah, the reference I made there, by the way, was to Annunzio Paolo Mantovani. I remember hearing some of his stuff when I was growing up, and he was basically, he took pop music and lightly orchestrated it. So he did a whole bunch of Beatles covers. Yeah. And so, and I think I may have heard growing up, Mantovani plays music from Exodus and other great themes. I think that's the album I'm familiar with. Oh. Yeah. I mean, so these are just lightly orchestrated with, just, you know, neither classic nor pop, like Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops. They're not even that classical. And he made tons of these things in the 60s and 70s. And this is right in that sweet spot. And the whole point here is, if you're going to make elevator music, do you need Bill Evans? Is it really necessary to have Bill Evans to make elevator music? Because that's what this is.
And of course, it was spun as a way to benefit Bill. But I don't see that the way it gets his name in front of people is going to do him any good as a serious artist, because none of his personality here to alert people that there's something special.
Exactly.
About.
Like if you're in an elevator and you hear this, right, and you're, you know, the people who are in elevators typically aren't going, gosh, this is really good. I wonder who's the. Can I find out who this is? It's so anodyne that it has nothing of him in it. So if the idea was to get interest in him, they've taken so much personality out of him that you can't know what you're listening to.
And yeah, listeners, if you want another example of this kind of music, listen to the end of the Cecil Taylor episode, because I do the outro to the theme from Summer Place. Just I had to calm down a bit. So. it's that kind of stuff. So, yeah, anyway, the slightest by far of these projects. Interesting anomaly in his, you know, what it was otherwise. You may think he's overrated, you may not. You may be a big fan, you may not be. But it's certainly, whatever you think of Bill Evans, is not worthy of what he could do. So the next oddity is this project that Tio
Massaro,
thank you so much. Tio Massaro, who was a very important producer at Columbia, did a lot of interventionist work with some of Miles Davis' sessions. You know, he was the one with the razor blade that kind of put Bitches Brew together. Anyway, Thelonious comes to Columbia after Riverside. I think most people agree it's not as inspired. Discography once he goes to Columbia, but certainly most of the music has merit on the label. I've enjoyed it. It's not my favorite, but it's mostly very good. By this point, Monk is, when he goes to Columbia, is kind of narrowing his focus. He's not writing much new material at all, and he's mostly playing in his quartet with Charlie Rouse. You don't have the encounters with other musicians that you know, kind of dot his earlier label efforts, certainly on Riverside, where he's with Clark Terry and he's with, you know, Sonny Rollins or John Colt. You know, it's just, it's very much just lots of sessions with Charlie Rouse. And I guess as his contract seemed to wind down, there's a sense that we need to put him, and there was a one big band project on Columbia that I think came out pretty well. We talked about that earlier. They thought, well, we need a new way of packaging him. And I'm going to say right now, I'm a little sympathetic to the idea that a new context might have been good, and that there is a certain amount of repetition, especially of context, for Thelonious on Columbia. It's mostly, as I just said, his quartet. So anyway, Tio puts together this kind of weird big band album, and it's pretty hated, I think, among Thelonious fans. I didn't react to it as strongly as I thought I might. I think there's a couple tracks here that are super big red flags for people. And then the rest is just kind of a project that doesn't work that well. I don't know how you thought about it.
Well, a lot of the reservations that I voiced about Thelonious Monk Big Band, that recording I'm going to bring up here, and they're even truer on this date. So if I recall, and maybe I'm not recollecting because I don't listen to these after we record them, but as I recall, one of my objections to that effort was that arranging Monk's stuff for big band means cleaning up, sanding off some of the oblique edges that make his music so vital and so interesting. And I felt that that happened more than I was comfortable with in that big band recording. But I liked it better than I like this. This, I feel, goes much farther in sanding off the edges and making monks safe for mass consumption. And at his best, monk isn't safe for mass consumption. Monk is meant to be, I think Monk meant himself to be difficult. He meant to be a challenging musician. I can't think of a better example here of something that cleans Monk up than the recording of Brilliant Corners. Which is just, you know, a swinging hip number, and you can just see a guy in a black turtleneck conducting this, and hey, scooty bop. And I think about those recordings, you know, with Monk, where he's playing that, and at every moment, it sounds like the song's about to fall apart, and it compels your attention in ways that you just can't stop. Like it's like watching a drunk on a high wire, and you think he's gonna fall off, and then he doesn't fall off. And then when you put it into this big band smoothed out context, I just imagine Monk in like a sequined jacket in Las Vegas playing, you know, a few chords with the big swinging band, and it's just everything that this music isn't. And I'll give him this. He's a gamer. When he plays in these contexts, he's trying to kind of fit in. He's trying to do his thing. But it's just made so safe. The arrangements make this. I would give this to someone who thinks Monk is really hard to listen to. I would give this to them and say, hey, give this a try. Because they might find this really accessible. But I find it empty. There's only a few moments where Charlie Rouse, he's here, right? He's playing tenor, and he is.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a few moments where Charlie takes off. There's a few moments where Monk gets some licks in, but man, this is just a little too clean for my taste. I mean, everything that makes Monk Monk is gone here, it feels like to me. The tension, the rhythmic tension that's just always paramount in Monk just isn't here. Rudy Tooty's another good example. It's just too clean and too polished. So, yeah, I don't like this very much at all. And what I had to say about the big band, I would say, goes double for this. That, by comparison, is a much more daring treatment than this is. This, my critique there really holds for this album, I think. T.O. didn't do Thelonious any favors, or maybe he thought he was doing him a favor by making him accessible, but to my ears, it makes him completely uninteresting. It's depressing. This just depressed me. When I listened to it, I always kind of went, you know, and I felt bad for Monk. I imagine Monk sitting in this big room with all of these people sighing like he's the dancing bear being trotted out to play a few of his tricky licks while the orchestration swells around him. It feels commercial and it feels sellout. I don't like this very much at all. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, and we're talking about Monk's Blues, 1969, and we discussed the big band quartet album on Columbia by Thelonious Monk back on episode 108. And I'm quite fond of that record. Mike, as you said, has mixed feelings, but I think we both agree this Monk's Blues from 69 is not a great effort. Yeah, it's, you know, Oliver Nelson is the arranger.
Oh, dear.
Well, you know, we say that, but my feeling with Nelson's always been that he's always, for me, for the most part, and there are exceptions, you know, you could say that Blues in the Abstract Truth is a pretty pure record, and he makes some pretty, and I like that record a lot. I like more Blues in the Abstract Truth, which gets a bad rap, but I think is actually very solid. But his larger band writing to me, and I've got the big set they did on Mosaic a few years back, there's always a tinge of, you know, kind of television sounds in it or whatever. He kind of straddles, you know, quote-unquote serious jazz writing and kind of commercial. You know, he became known later in life for things like the theme from the $6 Million Man. And, you know, he was kind of doing...
He did that?
Yes. Oh, wow. That's what I've been told. When I, you know, and I've been... Of course, he dropped dead at a fairly young age from basically overwork. So, yeah, this is not one of his inspired projects. Oddly, for a Thelonious Monk album, Thelonious, one of the couple of best known composers in jazz or probably 20th century music in America. Three of the tunes are not by him, but by T.O. So the one that I think gets people really upset is this tune called Consecutive Seconds, which is kind of in a boogaloo style. And that's, I think, the one that kind of freaks people out because it sounds like you're trying to put, you know, Monk on the set of Laugh-In or something. It's just it's like, what's going on?
It sounds like a game show theme song.
It does. There is a kind of soppy ballad there.
Just a Glance at Love.
There you go. I mean, you just know that Monk, who's one of the great titlers yes. of all time, would not ever call a song Just a Glance at Love. So yeah, there's just, and Monk's Point is another one that T.O. put together. So yeah, some of the songs are weak. I think when Monk plays, he just plays forcefully.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't, unlike Bill Evans, who kind of just loses his identity on the VIPs project, Monk sounds like Monk. It's just, as you say, he's in the smoothed out, kind of simplified context. They make brilliant corners. The song's so complicated that Sonny Rollins and a band of geniuses couldn't get it right all the way through for a single take, and so they had to patch together the take at Riverside on that album of that name. You know, it's a really tough composition. And here, they smooth it out. They simplify it. There's a little sped-up section at the very end, but they don't go back and forth the way the original recording did. You know, Monk's hitting the piano hard. It sounds kind of out of tune. Production-wise, the echo on some of these tracks is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, Charlie Rouse on Trinkle Trinkle, it's like there's Charlie and another Charlie from the mirror dimension. The echo is like its own instrument. It's not an additive to a sound. It is its own thing.
Well, and on that one, that's the one where the piano is really out of tune. That's painful.
Yeah, I don't know. Right. Yeah. It's like, what is going on here? They put echo on him, Monk sometimes. He sounds very detached in a sense, like he's been kind of cut and pasted into these arrangements rather than he's participating in them. The band certainly doesn't seem to be interacting with him at all. You know, it was not quite, I guess I imagine something that was more scintillatingly or laugh out loud commercial that was going to be funnier, darker, wilder than this is. I think most of this is just kind of mediocre big band writing with Monk playing Monk standards. And then there's a couple attempts at something even more, you know, something more commercial that kind of fall flat. But it isn't quite come to the level of outrage I was expecting from some of the reviews where I thought the whole thing was kind of him more or less doing a Summer of Love album or something
yeah.
or being stuck in the middle of one. You know, there aren't kind of girls dancing in cages or woo-woos in the background or something. But it's just not good. And I like both Town Hall and Big Band Quartet a fair amount. I mean, they're not my favorite Monk recordings, but I like them pretty well. This is not a place to turn. I mean, I think, again, you know, if you were 12 years old and this happened to be the first Monk album you ever listened to, you'd still learn something about what makes Monk great. And it could become a sentimental favorite of yours. Cool. I mean, I get it. But I don't think anybody who was going to set out to learn about Monk's music with any kind of guidance would ever be pointed in that direction. I mean, it's just, life is too short to mess with this. The Dangerous Liaisons, a soundtrack that just came out, probably worth looking at some point. You know, it's not my top 10, but it's quite good. It's a little different. But yeah, you're going to go through all the Riversides and the Prestiges and the Blue Notes and really all the other Columbias and the Black Lion. You know, at some point it's like, when would you find time to hear this? I can't imagine it. I don't think it's quite the incredible whitewashing, flattening that Bill Evans goes through. But, you know, Thelonious was just somebody who was always, he was never a chameleon, never somebody who melted in the wrong context away. He was always Thelonious. So you know, Teal'c can't take that away. It's just that he mutes it and he does not exploit it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it just, you don't benefit. Thelonious is there, but this is not doing him any favors. So
yeah, like I said, I would only give this to someone. I would give this to someone who's like, I just don't get Monk. I just hate Monk. I don't understand it. And I might give this to someone who loved Frank Sinatra but never understood Monk. I might give them this. And they could listen to this and they might start to grok Monk if they listened to this. But yeah, it's, boy, if you like Monk, this is going to be a tough road to hoe. This is not a good recording for Monk fan.
And of course, some people, you know, I remember a friend of mine in grad school, just, he's maybe a little too cerebral, a little too left field, a little too sardonic. And just, you know, some people are never going to gel with him. I've always had warm feelings about Thelonious, and I love him to death. And it's just hard for me to think my way into that position. But yeah, if this is the only album by Thelonious Monk that you like after trying hard, you just don't like Monk.
Right,
okay.
Right.
But it's still okay to get rid of this one.
Yeah.
Just keep moving along. Look for somebody. Maybe you like Bill Evans. Maybe you like Sun Ra. Who knows? Yeah. You know, but
yeah.
Sun Ra, you know, blown him his piano for this one, apparently.
Yeah.
I don't know what went on. And the one Boogaloo number, it sounds like utter garbage. I don't, maybe the tape got hurt at that point, or maybe it was just oversaturated. But, you know, when you look at Columbia, that's made some beautiful sounding records over the years. I guess they were not at their peak in 69, but how does an album come out from a major label that doesn't even sound decent? You know, you think if nothing else, you should be getting decent fidelity.
That and just, yeah, like I said, the piano consistently not in tune with, I think he's not playing in the same room with anyone. You know, I think they do the orchestrations and then they lay the piano down separately. There's no sense of that he and the band are in
right,
a room.
Man.
My sense is he's playing to playback or something. There's no sense of genuine interaction here at all. Ugh.
Yeah, and who wants to interact with that? I mean, and again, not that this writing is just incompetent or something. Oliver Nelson's a very talented guy, but it's very uninspired. Okay, well, anyway, now to a real oddity. Duke Ellington's A Drum is a Woman.
Yes.
And this has been one of the harder projects. Yeah, you know, if you're collecting him, this is one of the albums from the Columbia period that has been most often out of print.
Yeah, they let this one go, don't they? They don't worry if this one is in print.
No, and you know they did do a couple completes, which I didn't get because I had just about everything, and it appeared in, you know, the sort of one of the chronological trawls he released a few years back on CD of his Columbia stuff. But I think you can probably get an import of it. This we've been listening to is a very noisy LP dub. I got a kind of less than gently used LP of this because I never heard it and was curious. Spent a lot of time with the old D-Clicker, and it's still kind of noisy. But this was for a television show. And I've looked, and I don't think any record remains of that show. My God, I would kill to see it.
Yeah.
I have a feeling.
I can't imagine.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Holy cats.
But it's not quite, and maybe it's, I don't know if you want to call it an allegory. It is a story about Caribbee Joe.
Caribbee Joe.
And this drum tells him, I'm not a drum, I'm a woman. And it's Madame Zaj. In other words, Z-A-J or jazz backwards.
Yes.
Madame Zaj.
Whatever. Also, this is also... So, all right. So when we started, I mentioned Homer nodding. And I wouldn't say that Homer nods on Monk or Evans, because one doesn't have the sense in either case that these men are less than peak capacity. They just don't, you know, Monk is doing his best to cut through the schmaltz, and Evans just doesn't give a fuck. Right.
He just retreats like a snail into a shell.
Right, basically. Right. But in neither case do you think, you know, they're invested in this project and they want to make it work. I mean, if Monk is invested in that project, it's in trying to get himself heard over the orchestration. If that. But Ellington's a different beast, because Ellington, he composes this stuff. He's a composer. And when I listen to this, this is an example of Homer nodding. This is a place where Homer sleeps. Now, this album has its defenders, but I'm not going to be one of them. I'm going to be one of those people. If you remember, I think years ago, we used to look at the Rolling Stone Guide to Rock and Roll now and again, because I think Dave Marsh was one of the writers for that. And they wrote some funny stuff, especially about albums they hated. And
yes.
One of the groups that they talked about, something they said about someone reminded me of this album. And I don't remember if it was Dave Marsh or the other guy, but I think it was Dave Marsh. He had something to say about Pink Floyd. His claim was, like them or hate them, they never threw away an idea. Like, if they had an idea, they would execute it, no matter how stupid or brilliant. There were no bad ideas. There were just ideas. And they just followed them through. Whatever the logic was, they followed them through. And that's the sense I have on this album. Duke gets an idea and he's going to follow it through. Now, he may be writing. I'd like to know more about the TV show, because that makes a lot of sense, that he's writing this stuff to form for someone else. And one definitely gets the sense there are four movements, if you will, here, but they break into 3 and 4 minute segments, which is Duke's primary mode of composition. He's not a long form guy. He's 3-minute, 4-minute cells. And each of the movements here is composed of 2 or 3 or 4 of those movements, right? So there are 4 movements, the shortest of which is about 8 minutes, the longest of which is 16. And they break into segments. They break into these bits. And I have no doubt that an accomplished Ellington scholar would be able to identify repurposed bits, because Ellington never threw anything away, and he used stuff, reused stuff all the time. He'd put it in new contexts. But what's striking to me here is the thing that I find most interesting is movement 2, New Orleans, Hey Buddy Bolden, Caribbee Joe, and Congo Square. This weird, bizarre attempt to tell the story of jazz in New Orleans through the sweet format that Ellington is so fond of, where he sort of sutures different bits together. It's a failure, but it's fascinating. It's a fascinating failure. And I would love to see the TV show. I can only imagine. I can't even imagine, actually, what that would look like. All this stuff about the drum is a woman.
Right. I'm going to guess the costumes were pretty fucking awesome.
Yes.
And probably pretty skimpy.
I'm going to guess so, too. Yeah, this is definitely... So this is a weird Exotica take on, like, where Afro-Caribbean music comes from. Maybe that's the way to characterize this project. It's a 4-movement thing about Afro-Caribbean music.
Her feet are so motionless, you get the illusion that the tree stump in the center of the clearing is inching itself toward her. She is oblivious of the waves of desire generating in the crowd, thrilling to every gentle touch of the drum. Another drum, and another drum, many drums in counter-rhythm, and for every drum we hear, there's a woman to see. Their gyrations accelerate to a frenzy and a sudden stop.
With Ellington's trademark narrative vocalizations, where he sort of is introducing bits and pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And for once, they're really bad. Normally, when I listen to Duke do his little intros, right? When he does the intro, I think it's on the London live date and on the Paris live date, and he'll introduce Harlem and he'll talk about it. You know, he'll talk about, so we follow a hip chick, and then, you know, and then it's Sunday, and then there's a funeral, and then you have to imagine there's a civil rights march, you know. And when he does these articulate introductions, they're very suave and they're very cool. And here he does it, and it just sounds stupid. It's one of the rare occasions where you think, oh, Duke, stop. Just just play. Don't try and explain this. This is not good. And that's a rarity, because normally when you hear him talk about stuff, he's cool. I mean, he's effortlessly cool. And here he's effortlessly, I don't know, jejune. It's really icky. So yeah, I didn't like the narrative bits here at all. The playing is fine. Not great. I liked movement two the best out of the four. Movement one was the most disturbing. I don't know. What do you make of this?
Wow. Yeah, this is a problematic recording.
Yes. Especially if you're a woman.
There was a man who lived in Barbados. He saw a pretty woman one day. He took her home, and when they got there, she turned into a drummer. It isn't civilized to beat women, no matter what they do or they say. But will somebody tell me what else can you do with a drummer?
Yeah, no kidding. You're never supposed to beat a woman to this Caribbean thing, but what do you do with the drum? You know, it's like, okay.
Yeah, it's really disturbing.
Yeah, me too. Says hello. Yeah, it's. I enjoy listening to him talk. That said, a lot of this is unusually bullshit.
Yes.
Right. I mean, he's one of the great bullshitters, and one review was pretty well put it in Amazon. It's like, well, he's always bullshitting, but somehow here he's bullshitting more. You know,
right.
It's just there's a kind of a extra layer of insincerity or silliness.
Yes.
You know, if Ellington has besetting sins, one of them is sometimes he indulges in kind of cuteness.
Yes.
Kind of cute little things. And, you know, I'm sympathetic enough to him that I kind of deal with it. But here he gets very cute sometimes. And the narrative, which they say is kind of a grade school pageant level version of what happened, where jazz came from. It's weird. It's like a children's storybook. It's very allegorical. It just the whole, you know, whimsy about it just seems odd. It seems oddly misplaced. I mean, it's clearly a topic he cares about.
But it's almost a Disneyfied version.
Oh, very much.
I mean,
yeah.
There's no slavery here or oppression. It's just cute ethnic people in the ethnic world village coming up with cute hip rhythms and, oh, isn't that quaint how a drum is like a woman? Ha ha ha, you beat them both, right? Ick.
Well, the lyrics say that you're not supposed to beat it. It's wrong to do that. But yeah, the juxtaposition, you kind of feel like you cannot quite avoid. And of course, you see the cover. It's this voluptuous woman with a very curvaceous bottom sitting on a drum.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of like, okay. I don't quite get the role of Caribbee Joe, which you'll hear about 500 times the record, and Madame Zage. In other words, that if she represents these rhythms that come to the new land and become jazz and different genres of jazz or versions of it, and he goes back to the jungle, whether he is just supposed to be that he is represents the African and that it has to leave Africa and it stays in America, and finally the Africans don't. I just don't quite get what the point of that all is, that she can't keep Caribbee Joe and he sits down with other drums, and you know, I'm just not quite following the allegory at that level. So it's both very simplistic and maybe too complicated for my mediocre mind. I like some of the stuff in the third movement with the dance of the flying saucers, just weird, again, kind of cute stuff. And there is some poetry there.
Madame Zage picked up many influences along the way. And once I heard her say, "Come with me to my emerald rock garden, just off the moon, where darkness is only a translucency, and the cellophane trees grow a mile high. Come climb with me to the top of my tree, where the fruit is ripe and the taste is like the sky. Star rubies are budding in my diamond-encrusted hothouse, and the rhythm is melodic. The rhythm is rhapsodic. The rhythm."
When he starts talking about cellophane flowers and things, I'm like, well, I guess John Lennon didn't come up with this shit on acid in 67, because that language, that visionary language, and you know, some of the lines are just right out of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. clearly predates that. I don't know whether John Lennon saw the show on TV or whether that was just an image that was floating around that other people had used in kind of surreal contexts, but it was interesting to hear that.
And, you know, I will give it up. I mean, the band is in fine form, especially the brass. They get some screaming blasts, especially in the fourth movement. I don't know if it's Cat Anderson. I don't know who's playing the high trumpet there, but they get some of, you know, these signature blasts throughout the fourth movement, especially. This is not a fail at the level of execution. This is a fail at the level of conception. Like, this is an ill-conceived project.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
It's not an ill-executed project. How could it be? With Ellington's band, it's always going to be impeccably played. It's just, I'm not sure this was a good idea. Like, this is one of those where you sort of go, like, you listen to it a bunch of times and you think, right, it's Ellington. I must be missing something. And after a while you go, no, he was a little stoned when he made this one. This is not Duke at his best. I've listened to this now many times through, and it doesn't get better. It doesn't improve. I don't suddenly have this moment where the light dawns and I go, oh, I see what he's doing.
Well, I think it's a project.
Yeah. I would like to see the images that go with this that might make it better. It might make it worse, but they would be stunning.
They're probably too hot for the culture today in terms of the politics and the optics of them, as he used to say. Yeah, for me, what happened was, as I listened to it more, the overarching narrative and the problems with the conceit or the allegory and all that remain. They don't ever get better. But I was able to notice a nugget of interesting writing or a good instrumental passage. I'd say that they're very thin and few between. In other words, this is just not the place to go to hear Ellington and his band at their best, either compositionally or in terms of improvisation. It's just too diffuse and weird. I mean, I'm glad I've heard it. I don't think it's utterly without merit. But yeah, it's just a very strange thing. And I think that Ellington is a very shielded person, somebody who did not share his inner self with anyone that I'm aware of. And was a great performer and enjoyed performing so much that he would kind of perform his own performance in front of audiences and kind of make a joke of the fact of how mannered he could be, you know, how hard he was working at being charming and how you couldn't get past, you know, he was kind of playing with that in a way that you could delight in his delight in his own play. But when he gets to something that matters to him, that is a real problem because you can't face it directly. Clearly, the origins of jazz are important to him. The fact that jazz has become a more dignified music, the fact that his status as an African American is still keeping him from recognition and prizes that he believed probably were his due by that point. It's personal in a way, and so in a sense, he seems to retreat even more deeply into whimsy and allegory and cuteness and irony and distance. And the result is this weird, you know, it's not as bad to say the movie of Sergeant Pepper's. But it's not great.
No.
You know, where you felt like there, it's just like literally you want to celebrate this music and you cannot in any way, shape, or form connect with what it's about. I mean, it's just you're too deep in the decadent 70s to make any sense of the place that it came from. But yeah, you get the sense here is he's got all these defensive mechanisms going 110%, and the result is, yeah, I mean, music that, again, you know, if you never hear this particular Ellington album, it may be the least of all the ones he did on Columbia. And I love certain albums that people don't tend to think much of. Duke Ellington at the Ball Mask. I love that album. I mean, it's just a bunch of covers. It's got these silly spliced in clapping. I still think it's a great record. It's silly in some ways, but it's fun as hell. This one, yeah, I love Ellington's voice. I mean, there's, you know, he can narrate many things to me and I'd enjoy it, but yeah, this is a troubled project. Any other thoughts on beating drums but not women?
Nope.
An important lesson we all should
learn.
Let's
move on.
Love me. Give me love. Give me love, Wood. Give me love so that I can kill. Give me love because I can kill. She's unreal.
The devil.
And she must
there
die.
To accomplish the devil's deed. He is the son of man. He is the son of God.
Kill.
He is the evidence
kill.
Of God.
Kill.
He is the victim
kill.
Of God. He made me
I
know
am
that
I
can play the guitar.
I am me.
I can.
Well, that was strange. But you know what could be stranger?
Yes.
How about Sing Me a Song of Song Me? Wow. This is a kind of a 40-minute mind fuck that there's a fair amount of Freddie Hubbard's group playing on, and the rest of it is choruses and poetry recitals and tape collages and musique concrete.
Yes.
And weird ass shit, man.
The best way to explain this is to tell people, think of on the White Album, Revolution Number 9. That's what this is, except it's 40 minutes long. And it's a little...
And a lot more music.
A lot more music. That is less... That, you know, that's the Beatles' example of music concrete. I gotta tell you, I have a real high threshold for this, and I like the hell out of both of these. I don't know that I consider this a Freddie Hubbard project. You know, this ought to be under the name of the producer, some Turkish guy whose name I can't pronounce. I saw it, but I can't pronounce it.
I can't either.
It's some Song Mi or Son Mai. I don't know how to pronounce that. Is a village in Vietnam. So this is a Vietnam anti-war, anti-violence, big idea, big capital B idea, capital I project. I don't care about, I mean, well, I guess I do care about that, but I just find it absorbing. Whenever this came on, I could not take my ears away from it. I don't know that I'd call it jazz. The sections where Hubbard's group are playing are jazzy. But there's plenty of stuff on here that is just, you know, spoken word, choruses, found. I don't know if it's found or recorded snippets of talk, but I find it a relentlessly interesting collage. I actually like this. I'm hard pressed to characterize it. I know that it's meant to be some kind of protest. It starts out very disturbing with this female voice chanting. It's very scary, actually, and there's about a minute of that before you get synthesizers, and then Freddie starts playing some very comforting flugelhorn. I think it's a flugelhorn. It sounds warm and throaty and friendly, and then it opens up and he goes to a trumpet later, and then it's a little less warm and friendly. But this has got all kinds of ominous orchestration, lots of spoken bits. I like the hell out of it. I don't know what it means, but I can't not listen to it when it comes on. Like when I was, you know, had this on random, I just found it compelling. I was driving through a rainstorm. That's putting it mildly. I was driving through a hurricane in central Texas on my way to Houston. And I've never been in scarier weather in my life. Now, I'm from the Midwest, and I've seen funnel clouds or things that almost were funnel clouds before they touched down just out of sight. So I know what scary weather looks like. I have never been more terrified in my life of weather. It's driving east on, I-10 outside of Houston, and it was a fucking hurricane. At noon, it was black outside, and we were elevated, and there was lightning on both sides of the road, and there was no visibility at like 10 miles an hour. That's how hard the rain was coming down, and there were lightning strikes on either side of the road, and there's just traffic at a crawl, and I'm listening to this. And it was a fitting soundtrack for what I was going through. I was like, yeah, man, this is the right setting. Maybe I was just in the right setting for this. You know, it works better with thunderclaps to the left and the right. When I say thunderclaps, I mean like lightning strikes visibly off to the left or off to the right. You're from the Midwest, not those where you see the lightning and then you hear the clap, you know, 30 seconds later. Right. This is, you know, pow, you know, it's like you think the car's been hit. That's how, and this is noonday and I've got my lights on and it's like black, like you can't see. And this was playing. And I just felt right at home. I was like, yeah, man. Yeah, I dig it, Freddie. I'm down. fuck the man. We really screwed Vietnam. This is terrible. It worked for me. I like this. Don't ask me to characterize it other than to say, like you said, it's a 40-minute mindfuck. And if you like mind fucks, you're going to like this. There's enough of interest going on, especially with the verbal bits, that it always retains interest for me. It's always compelling. I wouldn't call it entertaining.
Right, yeah.
You don't listen to this and go, oh, yeah. Like, Revolution number 9, it has bits, you know, and there's some repeated motifs that you kind of get into. But this is just disturbing. Interesting and disturbing all the way through. And I liked it quite a bit. I take it you don't like it as much as I do.
I liked it pretty well. It is very strange. Again, it's really an accident of history that Freddy's name is on it. That said, he and his group, this is his quintet with Junior Cook, tenor, Kenny Barron on piano, Art Booth on bass, and Louis Hayes on drums, so a very fine quintet. They play, I'm going to guess roughly maybe 15 or 20 minutes of this project. Yeah. And some of the jazz is quite out. Some of it is more chordal. You know, we've talked at length about Freddie. He's a fascinating figure in that his heart always seems to be in the mainstream, but he could play avant-garde and is on some of the most, you know, some of the major avant-garde albums of the era. So he's just a guy that could do both those things. And let's see, we talked about him, devoted an episode to him, episode 95, where we looked at several of his recordings, Freddie Hubbard. But yeah, he's not running things here. He is a featured artist, in a sense, in this collage. Apparently, some of the early quotations are being read by actresses, but came from like trial transcripts of, I can't remember if it was Sharon Tate or who it was, you know, just really disturbing crime.
The Tate murders are part of the backdrop to all of this. So, helter skelter, literally.
You know, I can hold a knife. I can play guitar. Just weird things. It's much, I think, as opposed to Revolution number 9, which I feel like was just the Beatles experiment.
Right.
Without much to say beyond the experiments here, he's definitely trying to create a mood and an arc. And it starts extraordinarily dark. There's a point where I think it's Freddie Hubbard who's reciting the stuff about the black man and being put on a cross of steel and things.
You, black man, U.S. Army private first class. For freedom, you shoot down your own freedom. Your body lies crucified on a steel cross.
And then at the very end, you know, I think it is the producer himself saying, and yet there could be love, and the purple grass could love the red grass. So there is an arc. There's you go through a series of feelings and images, and you come out a different place than you begin. You've got to be willing to put up with 60s political acid-influenced poetry, right? If you want really coherent statements, you're not going to get them. You know, this is abstract. Some of the images may just seem silly to you or trite or dated. You know, there's a huge fingerprint of the era on this. But I actually liked it pretty well. I think you've really got to listen to it very closely. This is the opposite of VIPs. It's not background music. You know, it's not meant to soothe you.
Right. And it won't let you make it background music. Like, I would be impressed if someone could listen to this and not pay attention to it, because I would actually be a little disturbed. I would think, how can you ignore what's happening in your ears right now?
Yeah, if you're used to hearing voices saying things like that in your head, you need help. So don't listen to this record. Just immediately go to your nearest psychiatrist. And of course, there's serious tape manipulations going on. Occasionally, they're going to play Freddie's trumpet backwards. You know, there's this one transition, I think, certainly the first half of the album, where he's playing fairly normal, whatever that means, jazz with his group. And then these things start kind of bleeding in, these weird sound manipulations and external sounds, and it kind of gets absorbed into the fabric of this larger project, and it gets stranger and stranger, and then pretty soon we're back to poetry recital or sound effects or something. And there's some poetry read by a fairly famous Turkish poet. There's a sequence where it's like, you know, you can burn my fields, but don't kill my cattle, or, you know, just a series of images about what the speaker is willing to give up and what the speaker wants to preserve. So I like it pretty well. I mean, it's, you've got to know what this is. Don't go into this expecting a Freddie Hubbard album. This is not First Light or Red Clay or Ready for Freddie. And it is a kind of thing that I'm guessing most listeners would not have heard before. I certainly can't quite say, you know, I keep thinking someday I'm going to listen to Elevator Over the Hill, the huge rock opera project Carla Bley put together. I wonder if that is one of the closer cousins to this in terms of creative music of that period, in that she apparently uses some speech, and I don't know whether she uses found sounds, but, you know, she's not miles away. She's much more kind of quote-unquote musically oriented, but if you listen to the original Ballad for the Fallen, there's a couple little tape interpolations and, you know, nothing like this. That's a much more straight-ahead accessible record, avant-garde as it is, but you get the feeling she's feeling some of the same vibrations this guy was into. This is a real production. It's quite a record. And it's, I don't know, I think it's probably worth hearing, right? You know, you seemed on board, you'd suggest maybe.
Oh, yeah. No, this is far and away the thing that I liked the best this week. I mean, I enjoyed this quite a bit. The closest analogs, I mean, for our listeners, closest analogs would be Revolution Number 9, if you know that cut off of the White Album. But for me, it reminds me a lot of... So I know a bit about music concrète, and I don't know how you want to pronounce that, if you want to do the French pronunciation, concrète. But I have a high threshold for some of this stuff, and I have a fair amount of some of the more oblique stuff today. But I mean, the place to start would be like Edgard Varèse, and Varèse's, some of his early music is really forms of this, you know, in the classical setting. So I like this quite a bit. I've heard years ago in Chicago, right before I left town in 2001, the classical radio station, some guy had found a bunch of recorded tape in some studio somewhere, and he just spliced it all together, and they gave it a world premiere on one of the classic radio stations, and it was found music and interviews, and I just, that stuff is dead fascinating to me, and I can listen to it all day. So yeah, this just kind of hit a sweet spot for me. I like this quite a bit. But yeah, it's not really a Freddie Hubbard project. I mean, I think that it's got his name on it on account of he's the most famous person here, but this is the deep end of music concrète. And if you like this, there's a lot of stuff like this out there. It's just not, you don't hear about it a lot, but there's a whole bunch of music like this. So I guess initially it was kind of a French form, but, or the, you know, the many of the early purveyors of this music are French, but there are plenty of other people, Americans and others, who do this stuff. There's a whole bunch of names you can sort of look up who do this stuff, but this works for me. I like this quite a bit. It's not very jazzy, but that's okay as far as I'm concerned.
So, yeah, of the four, I'd agree. I for me, just because I love Ellington so much, probably that project is the next most interesting. It does not succeed. I think this probably kind of does what it sets out to do. What it's trying to do, you may not like, but Sing Me a Song of Song Me does, I think, at the end of the 40 minutes, kind of shake you up, kind of expose you to a lot of freaky ideas. Again, at times, some of its rhetoric may sound kind of dated. It depends on whether you can kind of endure poetic expression from that era, because it's some of the images may just seem, I don't know, to fail for you, not to work, not to reach you because of the era they come from. But I'd strongly recommend streaming it, looking it up. But again, if you want to kind of explore the stranger outer reaches of where music meets these other forces.
Where music meets noise.
There you go. But again, yeah, or narrative and sound. And again, you know, the tape manipulation and It's a very interesting blend, and I don't know that I've run across anything quite like it.
Yeah, I guess the point is that this stuff isn't random, that when you initially hear it, it sounds random. But of course, there's an editing mentality behind all of it. So again, to reference Revolution Number 9, you know, it too has an organizing, I wouldn't call it a narrative, but it does have an organizing principle behind it. It's not just one damn thing after another, although it often sounds like one damn thing after another. There is a kind of thread that runs through it. So this is like that. There's a narrative here. It's not merely random agglomerations of sound and text. There's a point being made here, but it may not immediately be apparent when you first listen. But I think it's worth, if you have a high threshold for this, this is definitely worth looking up. If you're a Freddie Hubbard Red Clay man, don't go here. You'll be unhappy. Right. If you're Freddie Hubbard is a 4-star monster of hard, late bebop, early modal, then don't listen to this. But if you can wrap your mind around some of the weirder things Sun Ra does, this would be for you.
And it is, I'd say that the difference between this and Revolution is that Revolution, in a sense, the pattern it ends up with is the pattern you bring to it after listening to it long enough. You know, you learn the sequence, and so the sequence starts to have a kind of sense to it because it's, you know, filling these gaps in for you. Where here, I feel like the creator is much, there's more intentionality. He is more trying to send you, point you at certain feelings. It's not just let's experience a random wash of events. It's let's think about violence,
true,
what it means to be human, the war, that sort of thing. But yeah, it's a weird project. But I enjoyed it. I'm glad that we were able to focus on it. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 144. This is the first podcast I've edited on a moving train, a grounded plane, and in 4 different countries. So hopefully it all hangs together. If you'd like, stay tuned after this for a long dissection of the Lovecraftian rock opera, The Dreams in the Witch House. Mike and I talk about the career of H.P. Lovecraft, as well as many details from this recording, at great and really pointless length. But if you'd like to torture yourself with that little morsel, please do so and enjoy. As always, you can contact us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. You can drop me a line on Facebook, or if you like, look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Mixcloud. Eventually, we'll get back to posting to All About Jazz. We're in a period of transition. Stitcher, it's all over the place. Tune in next time as we talk about a collection of work by English artists, mostly pretty young. We'll be talking about recordings from Shatner's Bassoon, the Zoe Raman Trio, Sons of Kemet, and Jason Ribello, along with a brief look at the Hedvig Molstead Trio's latest release. Until next time, take care.
Oh dear. All right. Loins have been girded.
Glad to hear it.
Here.
Here.
So we're going to devote a little time to discussing a rock opera based on one of author H.P. Lovecraft's short stories, The Dreams in the Witch House. And I think its date of release was roughly a couple billion years after Cthulhu sunk down into the ocean and awaited his inevitable rising. I'm not sure the exact date. Wow.
One of the best covers ever.
Yeah, it's all spooky and stuff. Not as spooky as the contents.
Great Great cover art. I mean, great cover art. I could look at it all day long. It's this weird agglomeration of faces melting into other faces, all in a kind of primal scream, as if you didn't need, so you don't really need this. The name of the album and the name of the group are the same, Dreams in the Witch House, which run vertically on the right side of the album cover, with a crucifix serving as the T in Witch House. How cool is that? And then, and this has to be one of the greatest wastes of ink ever, on the left side, it says in blood red ink, a Lovecraftian rock opera. Like, could it be anything else? When you look at this cover, would you say to yourself, ah, yes, a fine classical, of course it's a Lovecraftian rock opera. Totally needless advertising there. I do love the cover, and I could lose myself in it forever. It's wonderful.
At least 10 minutes after taking a really deep hit. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, this is, as I said in brief a couple episodes back, this is amazingly competently done while completely sapping my belief in the power of music and rock and meaning of any kind. It's just awesome. I mean, it is nihilism made music, or music made from... It's
the musical ability here is really quite high.
It is. This album has everything but taste.
These people make Sting look like a poet laureate because the rhymes these fuckers come up with are amazing.
I don't know what's true anymore.
Reality. I always thought it had finality. Now I doubt its actuality. Nothing is what it might seem. Non-entity. I've lost all sense of my identity. The only thing I feel with certainty is that the world is just a dream.
Amazing rhymes, just incredible. Yeah, it's hard to imagine people invented this.
Well, maybe people did, maybe people didn't. We don't know. The real origins of this are probably as deep as space itself. You really almost have to get into poetic theory about why these lyrics are both competent.
We need to back up many steps. Tell the class, because you're the expert, tell the class about H.P. Lovecraft, first of all, so they have an understanding of what the fuck this album thinks
it's doing. H.P. Lovecraft is a really pissed off dead guy, because as I said two episodes ago, he labored in obscurity, very eccentric, reclusive guy, who I think was deeply influenced by the fact that his dad ended up in an asylum because he went mad from syphilis, and... his vision of himself was he was of a fine old New England family that was decaying, and he was racist as hell for most of his life. I think he finally kind of woke up out of that problem. He got a little woke towards the end, but it took him a long time. There's a lot of disturbing racial imagery in him. But he's kind of an influential author now, and it's interesting because he's become canonized, and now there's some stories of the whole bookcases. It turns out that Scandinavia is great for science fiction book stuff. I mean, there's a science fiction book handling chain in Sweden that is enormous. I mean, you look and you didn't realize this many fantasy novels had been written ever. And then there's a place in Copenhagen in Denmark that's even bigger. It's like an empire. It's like kind of a boho section of town. They own parts of 5 different buildings. You know, one is the costume and DVD place, and one is the statuettes and playing cards place. It's just unbelievable. And again, the amount of nerd culture that exists on this earth is overwhelming. But this is where I saw this album.
He'd gained abstract mathematical knowledge beyond human comprehension. We were all astounded by it, especially our teacher, Professor Upton.
So many questions, science is a vast frontier. A theory is put in line. Deep exploration of concepts we hold dear. We equate and we describe. Our calculations never end.
Lovecraft, just to point out, he's essentially a horror writer, and he is now canonized, officially canonized. He labored in obscurity, but the equivalent, so in France, they have this series of books called Pléiades, and all the classic French writers have Pléiade editions. And some couple of decades ago, people decided the U.S. needed this, and so there's an organization called the Library of America, and they publish these elaborate authorized texts of canonical American authors. Lovecraft now has had for some time a volume in the Library of America series. He's officially arrived. It's called Tales, and it has the Call of Cthulhu, The Color Out of Space, At the Mountains of Madness, and a bunch of other stories. So he's this weird horror writer who's now officially, amazingly enough, officially canonized as a kind of an American classic.
There are dozens of complete editions of his work. Penguin has volumes of his work.
And tell the class about Cthulhu and the Mountains of Madness. Just give them a little overview of HP, right, if they've never...
Real quickly. I mean, probably everybody knows this is the thing. In my lifetime, he's gone from being fairly obscure to being, at least in the nerdiverse, universally recognized. In joke, it's no longer in anymore. But yeah, his big thing was cosmic horror, the idea that the scary thing about mankind was it was an accident, and that things going on behind its knowledge by elder races, ancient beings, are the real story of what makes the universe important and the real powers. And humans are just kind of this triviality who get caught up in the machinations of beings and forces larger than themselves and crushed like bugs. That is kind of his overarching theme.
And the crushing usually involves some sensitive plant of a narrator losing his mind when he comes to the realization.
Absolutely, right.
That we are not alone. We are actually cockroaches on the planet, and these elder races, these weird, bizarre creatures, have existed long before us. And it drives always, it inevitably drives these narrators to insanity.
And of course, there are dozens of games based on Lovecraft's universe, and they tend to have some kind of sanity. Sure. And he's a very florid writer. He was one of the guys that was used a technique of telling something that had existed in the real world. You know, Call of Cthulhu is like almost a collage of different like little news reports and things. He keeps talking about the Necronomicon again and again and again, as if it was a real book to the degree that some people think it is. And you'll see that from The Evil Dead on. I mean, movies, all sorts of places reference it.
Long ago, light was elusive. Darkness brought me dreams intrusive with legends and lore, legends and lore. Women then lived in God's shadow, drawn by men into a halo.
It is this book he made up, but because he acted within his fictional world as if it was a real book that everyone knew about and just referred to it the way one might refer to the works of Shakespeare, it has this effect as you're reading it, if you don't know about the joke, of kind of making you think, well, is this some book I just don't know about? And he wasn't the first to ever do that, but he was an early person who did it.
And one of the most dedicated practitioners of that art, like in story after story after story. He's got this richly conceptualized universe that he just constantly, it's the background in his universe.
Yeah. Stories are in a shared world. The Cthulhu mythos is kind of, at least about half of them, all kind of draw on this basic ideas and refer to one another, and there's certain Arkham that keeps getting referred to in story after story. So they kind of knit together into this larger vision. And we've learned from the success of Tolkien, and I've never been able to finish The Lord of the Rings, either the movie or the book, but you know, if you're a world builder, that can make you very influential. And right now in entertainment, you look at Marvel or whatever, it's this whole idea of the universe. It's not the story, the narrative anymore. Yeah. It's the larger, all the moving parts. And he had that, you know, in the early 20th century.
Yes. It boggles the mind to think that he's 100 years ahead of his time. If he'd been born 100 years later, there would be like Harry Potter, you know, how there's Harry Potter amusement parks, you know, there'd be Cthulhu theme parks.
Probably, know? I mean, with the exception that his stories, as opposed to Harry Potter, are not stories of empowerment. They are not stories of love.
They're not uplifting at all.
I don't think his
all.
Characters yeah. even eat. There is no...
Are there women in
absolutely
his books?
Not, because that would be too scary. I mean, we're already dealing with Cthulhu here. We don't want women. Yeah.
I mean, it's like a world of enervated bachelors, and they're always, you know, they're like, the solution you want to tell all of them is you should get laid.
No,
you know?
That would be way too traumatic. Yeah, he was briefly married to a Jewish woman, which was ironic given his views on race at that time. But yeah, he does not seem to have been a major part of his existence. Again, his stories are not part of the humanist tradition, really. They are not stories. They're not really part of the humanities. They're part of the inhumanities or the irrelevance of humanity. You know, there are stories about the fact that humans just aren't very important. And so he's not particularly interested in his characters as human beings. It's just more people finding out that things are so much worse than they ever imagined and snapping.
So naturally, a Scandinavian death metal group would pick up on this. It's a marriage made in heaven.
You know, well. So this is the paradox of this album. It is well made, well produced. The melodies are hummable. The lyrics tell a coherent story and rhyme, and yet they utterly miss the point of what Lovecraft's up to. It's too coherent. You know, if you listen to real good rock songs and you look at the lyrics, 90% of them, the lyrics don't scan into a coherent narrative. They are fragmented images about the feeling of it. This is just too controlled. There are so many feminine rhymes. It's hilarious. Multisyllabic words slamming together.
Tell the classes about feminine rhymes.
In other words, you're rhyming. And I read somewhere that I guess the actual definition is it's like a word where the stress is on the first syllable and then the other syllables rhyme with the rhyming word. The main thing I've always thought about it is a multisyllabic rhyme.
So blowing and knowing.
Right. Except these are almost more, I think I quoted one a couple weeks back. So at one point, reality, I always thought it had finality, but now I doubt it's actuality. Oh, yes. You know, it's like, though my all-time favorite thing is on the fine song Azathoth, where the voice singing Azathoth, which is 4 octaves lower than any human should sing, ends up saying, all space and time. And then he sings it again because it's a rock song. All space and time.
An ancient evil that lurks beyond all space and time. Space and time. As a thought, all appalling truths revealed as a thought. Rising madness unconcealed as a thought. At the throne of chaos yields you as a thought.
Okay, you're an evil god from another dimension. Are you really going to sing it twice? Is that really what evil gods cackling in the middle of nothingness do? Is they kind of get into it so much, they repeat themselves? I mean, it works. It is one of the funniest moments in rock music I've encountered for the last 5 years or so.
And these guys, what's kind of strange about this album, so I like some death metal. I have some death metal. This is bizarrely chirpy for a lot of death metal. Like, you know, I've got some angry Cookie Monster death metal. Cookie Monster.
Oh, yeah.
And these guys, a lot of the singing, apart from Azathoth, a lot of the singing is in the upper register and not screamy, sort of just earnest.
There's a bridge to the stars. The place is very
so it's weird. It's weird. So there are moments here that sound sort of Megadeth, and then there are moments that sound overproduced and schmaltzy almost.
Very Broadway.
Yes, Broadway. Oh, that's exactly right.
Well,
that's
again, exactly this has right. All space and time. And the story here is that there are a couple students who've rented cheap rooms in a house that is known as the Witch House. This woman, many centuries ago, escaping the persecution as a witch, just disappears from a holding cell before they're able to burn her. And the student in the garret where she was supposed to have lived or being held and disappeared from starts exploring strange mathematics, which lead to other dimensions and doing strange. Yeah, this is a story about weird math. And so there's this one song where he's like explaining his theories and like the math professor starts singing. And he's like, this is really strange. You know, it's just, it's so fucking funny.
There's something about there's this a character who appears in several Lovecraft stories, this magic familiar rat that the witch has. What's its name?
Brown Jenkins.
Brown Jenkins, who turns up in a few stories. Brown Jenkins makes an appearance here. And so what makes this so risible? I mean, there's so many things that make this risible. There's one of the students is telling the story to his local minister, and the minister keeps offering this anodyne. And the minister keeps saying, well, son, you just need to, you know, confess, and well, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the guy is like, no, you don't understand. And it's 60 minutes of, no, you don't understand. And there's always like a deeper level, like, oh, no, then this happened. And then he did this. And the minister always says, well, that can be disturbed. And, like, the minister keeps giving these sort of pablum responses to the horror that
like
we're supposed to be.
He's like the dumbest priest ever. Yeah, he doesn't get it.
He never gives the obvious response, move out, get a girlfriend. That's the obvious, response.
I don't think that's
going to
work, but sure.
Yeah, you know, his response is always, well, there are strange things in the world, and oh, one shouldn't look at those books, and one shouldn't do those things. And the other guy's saying, no, you don't get it, you know, and it's 60 minutes of, no, you don't get it. That to me was really funny. You know, when you first turned me on to this, I thought I was going to hate it from the get-go. And I remember on my first listen through, I thought it was just in bad taste, but I think it was horrific until about the third or fourth cut. It might be Bridge to the Stars. It might be Higher Fire Breaking Me Down.
To the Stars.
One of those songs, I was like, okay, this is stupid. But until then, I was like, this is all right. I've got stuff that's sort of like this. I've got some Mastodon. I know what this is. And then, yeah, we got to, I think it was the third or fourth cut. And I was like, oh, dear. then we get to things like No Turning Back and Signum Crucis. And I was like, oh, shit. This is horrible. And the final song really is Madness Is My Destiny. Oh, dear. This, you know, this needs to be heard, I suppose, to be fully appreciated.
Oh, there
but
will be
holy
clips.
Shit.
There will be clips. Yeah, well, so the narrator is this reedy voiced fellow student of the guy that goes mad at the witch house doing wacky math. And yeah, he's talking with this priest. It's like, yeah, then her head started spinning around and she was spitting out pea soup. And the priest is like, yes, sometimes you can get a little nausea if you move too quickly. It's like, dude, oh, that's terrible. He was dealing with the devil? This is, I read somewhere, and this is probably true. It's been a while since I've gone through the oeuvre, but apparently one of the only Lovecraft stories that really has any imagery from Christianity. And in a sense, it's just the religion is irrelevant to him. He thinks the whole thing is a joke. And so it's very weird. I mean, there are moments here that I was reminded of Christian rock. There are some songs that are very, you know, they're ascending, you know, the Bridge to a Star. It's like, yeah, this is like, it's an anthem. It's a happy anthem. What the fuck is it doing in an H.P. Lovecraft story? It just doesn't make sense. And of course, they make the witch sexy. Guess what musical the woman who sang this role was in and is known for on Broadway?
Oh, dear. I don't know. Wicked.
To look away, the time has come to abandon absolution. Your body shivers, the quest's begun. Penetrate God's grand delusion. I'm here, your fantasy.
She was in Cats. It had to be Cats. And I mean, she's fine. You know, because I watched a little bit of interview with her. Lots of personality. According to the interview, she auditioned for some kind of stage production with Meatloaf and scared him. So he said he didn't want to work with her. She was too intense.
Wow.
And she's a pleasant, attractive woman. But obviously she's having a lot of fun with this role. The guy singing Brown Jenkins is just so hilariously, because he's the one that's closest to kind of the devil metal voice. And it took me forever to figure out, who the fuck is that? Oh, yeah. It's the talking rat. Okay. Because I knew who the witch was. I knew who The guy playing the actual protagonist, the mathematician, is, I don't know, he's a little too throaty. It's weird because the star of the production is the guy that this doesn't happen to, the guy that's the friend who's telling right. the priest what happened to this other guy, not the one who experienced it. It was all in this weird third person. They have to find a way, I guess, to narrate it, but it does take some of the drama out when he's saying, and then they found out that this baby had been killed. You know, it's just like, you're not there. You're hearing about it afterwards from a second party.
And really, shouldn't the priest be getting more and more horrified? Like, the priest should be like, oh my God. And the priest is, everything is just chill. I want the priest from Amadeus, right? You remember the end of Amadeus after he gets the confession from Salieri, right? So the whole film is this frame narrative of Salieri confessing that he killed Mozart, right? Spoiler, I just ruined the movie for people who haven't seen it. So anyway, at the end, you see the priest who's been hearing this confession, and he looks like he's just drank poison. You know, he's like, what the fuck, right? Like, the priest looks worse than Salieri. He's like, heard all of this, and he's like, oh my God, oh my God. And just the look on his face tells you this is horrific. This priest, everything's groovy, you know?
Oh, my son, you should not swim.
It's okay.
Less than 30 minutes after having lunch.
It's amazing. This guy just nothing phases him. And then the rat started to talk. That is a weird thing. Right. He never freaks out. There's never a moment where the priest goes, oh my God, oh my God, right? The priest is always just calm. Everything's fine, which just feels wrong somehow.
Right.
Well, I don't know. I think they missed a trick.
Young Ladislas vanished last night. A pair of drunken townsfolk saw it all.
I hear shrieking through your walls. The devil's at our door.
Blessed are the faithful, for hell's on the horizon. The evil in this room of bliss, assault unto your crucifix.
This seems like this weirdly competent kind of school project, you know, making an opera about, you know, it doesn't ever feel felt in the bones and understood at some kind of primal level. It seems like it's all left brain expressing these ideas, including the screaming guitars, which, you know, again, you listen to it and it's like, well, just because a guitar is doing that heavy metal lick, it doesn't really have to mean anything, does it? It can just be, it's a purely abstract plug-in kind of thing. It doesn't touch you in any emotional way, but there it is. There's no catharsis. It's just kind of silly. But that's Dream of the Witch House.